This hour's top stories. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence rejects calls to invoke a constitutional amendment to remove President Trump from office. Israel launches fresh airstrikes on Syria as Lebanon announces an urgent complaint with the UN against Tel Aviv's repeated violations. Also ahead this hour, Tehran says U.S. allegations about Iran's ties with the al-Qaeda terrorist group show the failure of Washington's maximum pressure campaign. Welcome to the program. The U.S. House of Representatives is voting on a resolution that seeks President Donald Trump's immediate removal from office. A resolution calls on Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment. The article allows for unseating the president if he is deemed unfit for office. Pence, however, expressed his opposition to triggering the amendment. Democrats said they will bring impeachment charges against him as early as Wednesday if the 25th Amendment is not activated. Trump, however, has downplayed the risk of being removed from office.
And I'd like to say that free speech is under assault like never before. The 25th Amendment is of zero risk to me, but will come back to haunt Joe Biden and the Biden administration. As the expression goes, be careful what you wish for. The impeachment hoax is a continuation of the greatest...
Trump also called the Democratic-led efforts to bring impeachment charges against him a witch hunt, the phrase he had repeatedly used during his first impeachment. Earlier, he described the initiative by the Democrats as a dangerous move. The developments come as Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has reportedly said the president has committed impeachable offenses. Several House Republicans have voiced support for the impeachment. Trump is accused of inciting an insurrection to overturn the result of the November presidential election. Wide Radar correspondent in Washington, D.C. says Donald Trump's second impeachment enjoys more support than the first one.
Well, it's certainly a greater threat than it was the last go-around, in which the impeachment vote essentially came down to party lines. This time around, there is some movement among the so-called moderate Republican wing, notably Liz Cheney, the third-in-command of House Republicans, and, of course, the daughter of Dick Cheney. She is saying, quote, "There has never been a greater betrayal by a president of the United States of his office and his oath to the Constitution." Realistically, I think this is more to do with simply the maintenance of momentum, of ensuring that really that not only does Donald Trump never have a chance to come back to office, but essentially that the Democrats don't have to offer really much in the way of meaningful policy proposals if they are simply removing this as they present him sort of existential threat to American democracy.
Top generals of the U.S. Department of Defense have condemned the January the 6th attack on the Capitol by Donald Trump supporters. Eight members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and their chairman have, in a statement, slammed the violent raid as a direct assault on Congress and the constitutional process. The letter noted that any act to disrupt the process is not only against traditions, values, and oath, but also against the law. The statement reiterated that members of the armed services are bound to defend the Constitution. The Pentagon is deploying as many as 15,000 National Guard troops to protect President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th amid fears of new violence. The U.S. Justice Department says it expects hundreds of criminal cases to be filed in connection with last week's raid on the Capitol. The acting attorney for the District of Columbia said the department has opened criminal investigations of more than 170 individuals. Michael Sherwin added that the participants in last week's riots will face charges of sedition and conspiracy punishable by up to 20 years in jail. Meanwhile, the FBI stressed it has also opened 160 files so far, warning of many more to come. Supporters of President Donald Trump raided the Capitol building last week to Congress as Congress convened to certify Joe Biden's victory in the November presidential election. Violence led to the death of five people, including a law enforcement officer. And now, Syrian media say Israel has launched fresh airstrikes on the eastern parts of the country near the Iraqi border. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Damascus. To get more on that story, take a listen, please.
state news agency reported that there was an Israeli aggression on the city of Deir ez-Zor and the town of El Boukamal, which is in Deir ez-Zor countryside on the borderline with Iraq. After that, an official Syrian military source gave out a statement saying that about 1:10 a.m. Local time here in Syria, the Israeli enemy carried out airstrikes targeting Deir ez-Zor and El Boukamal, and that currently the Syrian military is assessing the results and the damage of such airstrikes without giving further details on what was exactly targeted. But definitely, since that Israel has carried out an attack, the target is definitely some kind of locations for the Syrian army troops that are located there fighting the remaining terrorist groups in that part of Syria.
The Lebanese president's office says the country will file an urgent complaint with the UN against Israel's violations of the country's sovereignty. It urged the UN to condemn the Israeli aggression and violations of the resolution that ended the regime's 2006 war on Lebanon. In recent weeks, Israeli warplanes have been carrying out low-altitude flights over Beirut and other major cities, including on Christmas Eve. Israel has also been using the Lebanese airspace to carry out strikes in neighboring Syria. The UN interim force in Lebanon says Israeli aircraft enter the country's airspace on a daily basis. Between June and October of 2020, UNIFIL recorded a daily average of over 12 airspace violations, a significant increase from the previous 4 months. Political commentator Firas Najim says Israel's repeated violations of the Lebanese airspace and sovereignty reveal the illegitimacy of the regime.
This is the regular that we always hear on the news, and it's become a very normality situation, you know, where the Zionist regime is, you know, violating all types of international laws, breaching, you know, airspace of other countries such as Lebanon, Syria. We've seen in Christmas Eve. This really reveals the illegitimacy of the Zionist regime, that they don't care about international laws. They don't care about neighboring countries' laws or any respect of sovereignty for other countries, because they never had sovereignty themselves. They never had legitimacy. So when a person is born out of illegitimacy, they believe they can do anything. They can break every law, and that's exactly what they're doing. What they're doing is because of Trump's last days in power, and they have full control of this man. They think that by doing all these type of things, they will be able to ignite maybe a war, and then America will jump in, and possibly, you know, then Trump can extend his power and stay in power and, you know, extend a couple of wars in the whole region. Well, I think it's too late now, to be honest with you, because they've had the green light. How much violations have they done? We see every day on TV how many kids they kill, how much journalists they kill, how much people they kidnap, how many places they demolish, how many annexations there is. Every law is broken, and there's nothing going on. The United Nations is sitting there blindly. They have these meetings. They condemn once in a while. But what are condemnations without implementations and penalizing the criminal?
Tehran says the recent U.S. accusations against Iran show Washington's frustration and the failure of its maximum pressure campaign. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said resorting to these, quote, old baseless tricks and claims will not help the U.S. repair its tarnished reputation. Saeed Khatibzadeh made the remarks in response to accusations leveled by U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that Iran has ties with the al-Qaeda terrorist group. Khatibzadeh said Pompeo had made the same accusations against the Islamic Republic in the past to divert attention from the real supporters of terrorism, which are Washington and its allies. The spokesman stressed that Iran has been a victim of U.S. state terrorism for years, adding that Iran has a clear record of fighting terrorist groups. Earlier, the Iranian foreign minister dismissed Pompeo's allegations as warmongering lies. Political commentator Cindy Sheehan says the Trump administration wants to leave with as much animosity toward the Middle East, especially Iran, as possible.
Pompeo has long been a warmonger, as your foreign minister pointed out, and I guess they want to leave with as much animosity towards the Middle East as possible, especially Iran. The Trump administration has spent a lot of time and energy demonizing Iran to the American public, which culminated last year, of course, with the assassination of General Soleimani. But Pompeo also redesignated Cuba as a terrorist, a major supporter of terrorism. And so I think it's just some more bombast coming from the hypocritical U.S. government. And as we know, if we can look at the past history, especially since 9/11, every action the U.S. has taken in the Middle East and around the world has actually increased animosity towards the United States. And I wouldn't call the people who are upset and angry against the United States terrorists. I would call them people. I would call them like freedom fighters who are protecting their own community and who rightfully and righteously want the U.S. to stop meddling in their affairs or occupying their countries.
The European Union has slammed the U.S. decision to label Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization. A spokesman for EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said the move could hamper UN-led efforts to reach a comprehensive solution to the Yemen conflict. He added that the designation will complicate the work of the international community on political and humanitarian fronts. The blacklisting is also feared to disrupt the delivery of international humanitarian aid to Yemen and further aggravate the country's economic crisis. Moreover, Washington's decision has drawn criticism from the UN and aid groups as well as lawmakers inside the United States. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has also condemned the move, saying it reserves the right to respond.
The Trump government enters its last day in office. Every effort is being taken by the White House and the State Department to divert attention away from its woeful behaviour at home and making sure that the international arena gets one last taste of Trumpism. The United States has introduced a fresh round of sanctions against the Yemeni Ansarullah resistance movement, going as far as labelling the group as a designated terrorist organisation. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo stated that he had declared three senior leaders of the movement as global terrorists, including Abdulmalek al-Houthi. However, it seems that by acting in this way, the US has done nothing to alleviate the ongoing war in the region, in particular when it comes to the terrible humanitarian disaster taking place in Yemen, which for the whole part sees the US and its regional allies wholly responsible for. With war raging on in the country, it seems that many people have forgotten about the disastrous impact on human life, with over 233,000 Yemenis dying from the impact of the conflict. It's hence why the Ansarullah movement has highly condemned the actions of Mike Pompeo, as well as the lack of actions by the UN humanitarian team, who has failed to act, in essence, making them equally as guilty as the Americans for their lack of positive action. With very little to no humanitarian aid being able to enter the country, has the actions by Trump and Pompeo made things harder for life-saving drugs, equipment and medicine to reach the country. Although not all lives have been taken from the impact of the war, it's the connected impact that has hit Yemen the hardest, with many people, especially children, who are suffering the most, either through the lack of clean, potable drinking water, lack of fresh and healthy, nutritious food, and of course through lack of much-needed medical supplies, in particular as Yemen, like all other global nations, is facing a pandemic that knows no borders.
Well, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the sanctions on Yemen's Ansarullah movement the weekend. The important point is that the move would exacerbate the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Yemen that is facing Saudi war and blockade for nearly 6 years now. The U.S. sanctions could also jeopardize any future talks between opposing sides in Yemen. Ansarullah has been quick to react to the sanctions and the U.S. designation of the movement as a terrorist organization. Ansarullah says the Yemeni people do not care about the designation. It says the U.S. is complicit in the killing of Yemenis and has promised to retaliate the American move.
When it comes to Yemen, the relentless campaign by the Saudi regime has caused a terrible loss of life and economic infrastructure to the country. Yet, every fire is being fueled from somewhere, And it's the United States that are fanning the flames in this case. In fact, in a similar last-minute action by the US on designating the Ansar Allah movement a terrorist group, the US has also struck a last-second deal to supply the Saudi regime with $290 million worth of arms, most of which, again, will be used in the war against Yemen, whilst at the same time funding the US military complex with the same brushstroke. But it's not just the Saudi regime that's guilty of crimes against Yemen. Its regional partner, the United Arab Emirates, is also embroiled in the war, and much like its neighbour in Riyadh, Abu Dhabi has also enjoyed the support of the US arms industry, securing a $23 billion arms deal with Washington, signed and sealed by none other than Donald J. Trump. With over 3,000 children killed since 2015 in Yemen, over 5,600 injured, and many more being added to the list on a monthly basis, why then are the people of Yemen being sanctioned and punished, yet those responsible for the atrocities are being rewarded by the US? With Trump having promised to end endless wars, why then does he continue to fund his regional allies, allowing the US to continue its global conflicts via its proxies? And will the arrival of a new US president spell any notion of change in US foreign policy, allowing the likes of Yemen to rise from the ashes and fight the humanitarian disaster that struck this ancient land?
Daily COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. have hit a new record with nearly 4,500 fatalities. According to data released by Johns Hopkins University, cumulative deaths in the world's worst-hit country have now surpassed 380,000. The average number of daily deaths in the past week has now surpassed the fatalities of the 9/11 attack. The U.S. has also so far registered more than 22.8 million cases of the virus. Over the past week, an average of nearly 249,000 new COVID-19 infections was reported every day. Vaccination is also underway in that country, where the government has come under criticism for the program's slow and chaotic process status. And EU legislators claim there is a lack of clarity and transparency surrounding the European Union's vaccine strategy. Member states in the 27-nation bloc are accused of not moving quickly enough to administer COVID-19 jabs. Jerome Hughes now reports.
As things stand, it is very unclear how many people in the EU have so far actually received a COVID-19 vaccine, how many doses are currently being sent to each of the 27 member states, and when various groups can expect to get the jab. EU lawmakers have been discussing the issue in the European Parliament.
European Union citizens have a lot less vaccines available to them than they should have. The European Commission has planned this badly. Perhaps they were too bureaucratic.
On the 15th of October last, the European Commission set out clear guidelines to encourage each government in the EU to prepare for vaccination rollout, including the need to have sufficient numbers of trained personnel.
We invite the members to reflect on making sure that the necessary infrastructure is in place, that the necessary equipment is in place, taking into account the technical specificities of the vaccines.
Despite being given 2.5 months' notice, many EU countries did not prepare. Vaccines were left in boxes instead of being put into people's arms. We have been speaking to citizens about the vaccine rollout.
Things are not that well done at the moment. I think that we lack some information about everything. People need to know.
It was too slow, but now we have vaccines, then we must quickly act.
Yeah, I think it's better to have done it safely, but I mean the price to pay is that it may take a bit longer.
More people have now been vaccinated in the UK than in all of the 27 EU member states combined.
Could we have been doing more about creating better capacity building for the manufacturing of the vaccines? And could we have done more in order to adjust the expectations from the citizens about the speediness of how we roll out these vaccines?
Some lawmakers say the credibility of the EU is being undermined by the fact that some member states, such as Germany, Denmark and Cyprus, are seeking extra vaccines outside of the European Commission's vaccine strategy. With the Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna vaccines having already been approved for use in the EU, the European Medicines Agency is due to give the green light to a third, the AstraZeneca vaccine, on the 29th of this month. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
a diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
America's 21st century wars have been tragedies for millions and have led to a proliferation of threats that damage the United States in fundamental ways, says Nick Terse, writer, in an article titled, On the 20th anniversary of the so-called War on Terror, is there any end in sight? Stay tuned, please, for the details. This is a different kind of war, which we will wage aggressively to disrupt and destroy terrorist activity, U.S. President George W. Bush announced a little more than 2 weeks after 9/11 attacks. Some victories will be won outside of the public view, in tragedies avoided and threats eliminated. Other victories will be clear to all. This year will mark the 20th anniversary of the so-called War on Terror, including America's undeclared conflict in Afghanistan. Despite neither a clear victory nor the slightest evidence that enduring freedom had ever been imposed on that country, U.S. combat operations in Afghanistan ended, according to the Defense Department in 2014. In reality, that combat simply continued under a new name, Operation Freedom's Sentinel, and grinds on to this very day. Like the 2003 invasion of Iraq, known as Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom and Freedom's Sentinel failed to live up to their names. Nor did any of the monikers slapped on America's post-9/11 wars ever catch the public imagination. The battlefields spread from Afghanistan and Iraq to Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, Libya, Syria, Niger, Burkina Faso, and beyond, at a price tag north of $6.4 trillion and a human toll that includes at least 335,000 civilians killed and at least 37 million displaced from their homes. Meanwhile, those long-promised clear victories never materialized, even as the number of terrorist groups around the world proliferated. What the future will bring in terms of this U.S. many armed conflicts is murkier than ever as the Trump administration pursues an array of 11th-hour efforts interpreted as last-minute attempts to make good on pledges to end this country's endless wars, or simply as sour grape shots at upending, undermining and sabotaging the deep state, the CIA in particular, while handcuffing or kneecapping the incoming Biden administration's future foreign policy. For 4 years, the Trump administration has waged a multi-front war, not only in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, and elsewhere around the globe, but with the Pentagon as well. Donald Trump entered the White House vowing to stop America's ceaseless foreign interventions and repeatedly teased ending those endless wars. He didn't. Instead, he and his administration continued to wage America's many conflicts, surge troops into Afghanistan and Syria, and threaten nuclear strikes against enemies and allies alike. When the president finally began making halting gestures toward curtailing the country's endless conflicts and attempt to draw down troops in various war zones, the Pentagon and State Department slow-walked, slow-rolled, and stymied their commander-in-chief, deceiving him. For example, when it came to something as basic as the actual number of U.S. troops in Syria. Far from ending endless wars, President Trump escalated the most endless of them. The conflicts in Afghanistan and Somalia, where America has been intermittently involved since 1970s and 1990s, respectively. Airstrikes in Somalia have, for instance, skyrocketed under the Trump administration. From 2007 to 2017, the U.S. military conducted 42 declared air attacks in that country. Under President Trump, 37 strikes were conducted in 2017, 48 in 2018, and 63 in 2019. Last year, U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, acknowledged 53 airstrikes in Somalia, more than during the 16 years of administrations of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. The reasons for that increase remain shrouded in secrecy. The uptick in airstrikes has been disastrous for civilians. While Africa Command recently acknowledged 5 deaths of non-combatants in Somalia from all such airstrikes, an investigation by Amnesty International found that in just 9 of them, 21 civilians were killed and 11 others injured. According to the UK-based monitoring group, Air Wars, evidence suggests that as many as 13 Somali civilians have been killed by U.S. strikes in 2020 alone, and Trump's recent decision to withdraw U.S. forces from there will not end those air attacks, much less America's war, according to the Pentagon. While a change in force posture, this action is not a change in U.S. policy, reads a Defense Department statement that followed Trump's withdrawal order. The U.S. will retain the capability to conduct targeted counterterrorism operations in Somalia and collect early warnings and indicators regarding threats to the homeland. The war in Afghanistan has followed a similar trajectory under President Trump. Far from de-escalating the conflict, as it negotiated a peace deal with the Taliban and pursued troops withdrawal, the administration ramped up the war on multiple fronts, initially deploying more troops and increasing its use of U.S. air power. As in Somalia, civilians suffered mightily, according to a recent report by Netta Crawford of Brown University Cost of War Project. During its first year in office, the Trump administration relaxed the rules of engagement and escalated the air war in an effort to gain leverage at the bargaining table. In all, the unit killed at least 51 civilians in Afghanistan's Wardak province between December 2018 and December 2019. As Akhtar Mohammed Tahriri, the head of Wardak's provincial council, told Quality, "The Americans step on all the rules of war, human rights, all the things they said they're bring to Afghanistan." After losing his bid for re-election in November, the U.S. president did issue a series of orders drawing down some troops from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. Virtually all military personnel are to be withdrawn from Somalia. There, however, according to the Pentagon, some or all of those forces will simply be repositioned from Somalia into neighboring countries in order to allow cross-border operations, not to speak of continuing targeted counterterrorism operations in that country. This suggests that the long-running U.S. air war will continue uninterrupted. The same goes for other war zones where American troops are slated to remain, and no cessation of airstrikes have been announced. News reports indicated that the Department of Defense is reviewing its support for the CIA. The reason former and current administration and military officials told Defense One was to determine whether special operations forces should be diverted from the agency's counterterrorism operations to missions related to competition with Russia and China. The New York Times suggested, however, that the true response could be to make it difficult for the CIA to conduct operations in Afghanistan. The troop drawdowns and 11th-hour policy changes have been cast by pundits and national security establishment boosters as the spiteful final acts of a lame duck president. Whatever they may be, they also represent a genuine opportunity for a president-elect who has voiced support for a shift in national security policy. Almost two decades after President George W. Bush launched a different kind of war, more than a decade after President Barack Obama entered the White House, promising to avoid stupid wars while promising to win the right war in Afghanistan, 6 months after President Trump committed to ending the era of endless wars, as President Bush put it in 2001, some victories will be won outside of public view, in tragedies avoided and threats eliminated. America's 21st century wars have instead been tragedies for millions and have led to a proliferation of threats that damage the United States in fundamental ways. Failed forever wars are, however, also a Joe Biden legacy. As a senator, he voted for that 2001 AUMF, the 2002 AUMF, and then seconded a president who expanded America's overseas interventions. And nothing in his personal history suggests that he will take the bold actions necessary to follow through on putting an end to America's overseas conflicts.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and here are some factors to contemplate upon regarding the all-glorious Creator, whom imagination cannot encompass, as described by Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, who is one without partner. He who cannot be perceived with vision, neither be described with tongues, nor can imagination surround his state.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd As-Salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-Tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and your program For Humanity, where we are discussing Imam Ali al-Sajjad's Risalatul Huquq, the Treatise of Rights. And we are up to right number 37, where we have been giving an introduction to the rights of your associates. Just imagine how our society would be if we were more cautious about who it is that we mix around with, especially for the younger generation, the youth, who might not see the cruel side of certain individuals. Young adults and teenagers, in most cases, are very, very innocent and sometimes simple and gullible, and might not see or even be able to fathom how evil certain individuals can become. You don't want to go down the dark paths. You don't want to be mixed up in the wrong crowd, as they always say, you know. And parents always point this out, you know, who are you hanging around with? Who is your friend? Don't mix with this person. Stay away from that person. Avoid this individual, you know, because you pick up on things very, very easily. And that's why one element of correct upbringing is you being cautious about who it is that you mix with. Making someone bad good, or making someone good bad. Someone might push you to something good, and someone might push you towards something bad. And that's why when you do want to associate with someone, you need to also be observant of their rights as well. Don't deceive them. Don't trick them. That's what Imam Sajjad says. فَلَا فَأَنْ لَا تَغُرَّهُ وَلَا تَغُشَّهُ. Deception is very, very evil and bad. And, you know, you might feel that you are able to cover up certain things, and they might be vulnerable, and you feed off of that vulnerability, and that is the worst thing that any individual can do. And so this is why when it comes to someone who pushes you to good or someone who pushes you to bad, the emphasis here is that very surrounding that you are in. When Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, he says, وَلَا تُكَذِّبْهُ or وَلَا تُكْذِبْهُ. And this can be read in two ways, where you can say, don't lie to them, and you can also say, don't accuse them of lying as well. As the hadith says, Al-Kidbu Miftahul Shar, that lying is the key to all evil. Another hadith says that if all of evil was placed in one room, was stored in one room, the key to that is lying. When we emphasize on such a thing with mixing and being cautious of who you mix with, this is a very reason why, because you easily pick up on habits. We mentioned habits and we said that, you know, something might be innocently adopted within your habits and then that becomes an addiction. And we know that there are certain individuals who are compulsive liars. You're not even able to tell who is telling the truth and what truth is there in what it is that they are saying. We're going to go for a short break and we will be back soon.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back again, and we've been reading some hadiths from our Prophet and our Imams, and we can also see that in books of akhlaq, in books of morals and mannerism and correct social conduct, we can see that there is an extra emphasis by our ulama on who it is that we guide or who we are guided by. And we always need to look at that in the positive way, where we understand that there is a responsibility that we carry, that we don't just mix with every crowd and we say, well, nice to meet you and my name is this, and then all of a sudden you become very close friends and things like that. No, here at this moment, we're not talking about your sadiq, your friend. We're talking about people who you mix with, your that environment that you are surrounding yourself with, because you need to make sure that there is good conduct from your side. You guide the associate, you be nice to them, you invite them to righteous things, and you never deceive them, you never trick them, you never try in any way to lie to them, or never accuse them of lying to you as well. Because Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, in what we can understand, an associate, right, is someone who you associate with. You know, he could be your classmate, it could be your fellow employee, it could be someone who is an individual who you've just become acquainted with. And Imam Sajjad, alayhi salam, he says, whoever you are associating with, they have rights over you and you have rights over them. Don't cheat them. Avoid any kind of trickery. And you should never, ever in any way lie to them. Now, there are many verses in the Holy Quran and traditions that speak about companionship as well. Your sahib, your sadiq, and these are just a few pointers that Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, is referring to. Look at what Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi has mentioned. Look at what our Imams have spoken about. So when he says this, that you don't trick them, and you don't cheat with them, and you don't deceive them, and you don't lie to them. And also, another important thing that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is saying is that you don't ignore them. We will speak about this in our next segment. Until then, please visit us on our website, www.parstoday.com, or you're able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Until our next program, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
French citizens fear that France is becoming a police state. They believe that the regime in Paris wants to limit their freedoms. France has been the scene of social violence recently. People in France are protesting against a draft controversial security law. The legislation, known as the Global Security Bill, restricts filming on duty police officers. Article 24 of the proposed bill makes it a criminal offence to publish images of on-duty police officers with the intent to harm their physical or psychological integrity. It says offenders could face up to a year in prison and be fined €45,000. Protesters describe the bill as France's way of curbing freedoms while preaching their importance to others. According to France's police watchdog, the IPGN, there were almost 1,500 complaints against officers last year, half of them for alleged violence. The timing of this bill couldn't be worse. It was voted right after a video was circulating online of the brutal arrest of a black music producer for not wearing a mask. The United Nations Human Rights Chief also urged France to withdraw a controversial part of its global security bill that would curb the freedom to share images identifying police. There's much truth to this statement. In France, it seems that racism and hatred against minorities and people of color is historic. France was a colonialist empire. The first colonial empire in France began in 1534, and the second colonial empire began in 1830. For example, Bordeaux was France's second largest slave port and prospered off the lucrative trade, deporting 150,000 African slaves to the Americans from 1672 to 1837 and providing Europe with goods such as cocoa, sugar and cotton. These historic realities are not mentioned on the banners. The new sign for the statue of slave trader David Gradis, who lived from 1665 to 1751 in the French city of Bordeaux, explains that he had 10 slave ships and provided a plot of land that became the city's first Jewish cemetery. It says nothing about his slave deals with American settlers. Another controversial statue is that of deceased colonizer Louis Faidherbe in the northern city of Lille, France. In the decades following the French Revolution and Napoleon's final defeat at Waterloo back in 1815, a new movement called Romanticism began to flourish in France. France, through many liberal and social movements, tried to paint a different picture of its past. But even the French president recently emphasized that France is the same as it always was and won't change its past. But racism is not the only problem in France. Recently, there has been a spike of Islamophobia there. After the controversial law on global security and the massive protest against it, the French government has approved another controversial bill, this time called Law on Separatism, provoking another round of popular protests against it too. France guarantees the freedom of religion by virtue of the 1789 Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen. The Republic is based on the principle of laicity, that is, of freedom of religion enforced by Jules Ferry laws and the 1905 Law on the Separation of the State and the Church. Paris has traditionally been associated with alternative artistic or intellectual subcultures, many of which involved foreigners. But it seems that things have changed in France, especially with the rise of Muslim immigrants there and across Europe. France's Prime Minister Castex openly said that this bill targets what he called radical Islam, enemy of the Republic. Paris has promoted the bill to target separatists undermining the nation and Muslims. The bill comes after outrage in the aftermath of a measure by French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, which reprinted offensive caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in October of 2020. Charlie Hebdo's measure drew strong criticism from Muslims in France and Muslim countries, who called it an Islamophobic act, despite which French President Emmanuel Macron refused to condemn the measure, citing freedom of expression and claiming that it was not right for a political leader to get involved in editorial matters. The cartoons were originally published by the Danish newspaper Jyllands Posten in 2005 and then republished by Charlie Hebdo in 2006. Human rights groups have raised concerns over the law, saying it would discriminate and stigmatize French Muslims. The bill in question requires that everyone strictly respects the French Republican principles of secularism, whatever that might mean. The funding of Muslim associations and mosques will be closely monitored. The main association in defense of Muslims, the CCIF, was dissolved. All organizations will have to sign a declaration on secularism if they want to receive funds from the state. In case of non-compliance, they would have to refund the money. In 1990, riots are triggered after two North Africans are shot dead. Also that same year, thousands of people commemorate killing of 17-year-old Moroccan in a racist incident. In 1991, police clash with French Arabs and North Africans. In 1992, tens of thousands of protesters take to the streets to demand change against racism. In 1993, the government approves a draft law to reinstate key provisions of its immigration law declared unconstitutional a month earlier. In 1997, thousands of protesters demonstrated across France against proposed legislation that would further tighten immigration controls. Minorities in France, whether people of color or Muslims, believe that the situation nowadays has got even worse. With the rise of police brutality against blacks and the rise in Islamophobia, supported directly by the state, they're going to have to live with new realities in a nation that has long preached human rights values and democracy while covering up its controversial racist and colonialist past.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
With the coronavirus transforming consumer spending habits, economists believe some portion of these service jobs won't return even after the U.S. economy has regained its footing. That trend will likely further widen the economic inequalities that have left millions of families unable to buy food or pay their rent. We now present you an article written jointly by Christopher Rugeber and Alexander Olson. The piece is titled, Once Again, Job Losses Fall Unequally Across the U.S. Economy. The article has been published by the Associated Press news agency. Ten months into America's viral outbreak, low-income workers are still bearing the brunt of job losses, an unusual and harsh feature of the pandemic recession that flattened the economy last spring. In December, the nation shed jobs for the first time since April. Once again, the layoffs were heavily concentrated in the industries that have suffered most because they involved the kind of face-to-face contact that is now nearly impossible. Restaurants, hotels, theaters, sports arenas, and concert halls. With the coronavirus transforming consumer spending habits, economists believe some portion of these service jobs won't return even after the economy has regained its footing. That trend will likely further widen the economic inequalities that have left millions of American families unable to buy food or pay their rent. Typically in a recession, layoffs strike a broad array of industries, both those that employ higher and middle-income workers and those with lower paid staff, as anxious consumers slash spending. Economists had worried that the same trend would emerge this time. Instead, much of the rest of the economy is healing, if slowly and fitfully. Factories, whilst not fully recovered, are cranking out goods and have added jobs even every month since May. Home sales have soared 26% from a year ago, fueled by affluent people able to work from home while looking for more space. That trend has in turn bolstered higher-paying jobs in banking, in insurance and real estate. Brad Hirschbein, an economist at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, and Harry Holzer, an economist at Georgetown University, concluded in a new research paper titled Such Differences in Employment Loss Between the Highest and Lowest Wage Workers Are Almost Certainly Unprecedented Among U.S. Recessions Over the Past 100-plus Years. On the surface, the December jobs report the government issued on Friday, 10th of January, was absolutely dismal. The economy lost 140,000 jobs. It was a sixth straight month in which the hiring has slumped from the previous month. Unemployment remains stubbornly high at 6.7%. But the negative numbers stemmed entirely from the brutal loss, nearly 500,000 jobs lost, in a category that includes restaurants, hotels, and entertainment. State and local government also cut workers. So did hair salons and other personal services. There were layoffs too in education. Nearly every other industry added jobs. Construction gained 51,000 jobs, financial services 12,000 jobs. Transportation and warehousing companies, beneficiaries of a surge in e-commerce and delivery services amid the pandemic, gained nearly 47,000 jobs. Hirschbein said in an interview, job losses have definitely been very heavily concentrated in certain industries, much more so than prior recessions. Once the coronavirus vaccine becomes distributed more widely,